The crime of contributing to the abuse of a juvenile requires the state to show that the juvenile was subjected to a substantial risk of physical injury by the juvenile's parent, guardian, custodian, or caretaker. In a case where a school resource officer encouraged a juvenile to tase herself, the Court of Appeals has reversed a conviction for contributing to the abuse of a juvenile because the state failed to show the required relationship. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Sanchez, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, is it the word competency or capacity that describes a defendant's not understanding the proceedings? I think the Court of Appeals recently used the word competency. Tell us about State v. Cook.
Yeah, Joe, I'm not sure that I have a clear answer to that. I think it is capacity to proceed. And then I think when we talk about competency, we're talking about like the competency of a witness, you know, to get up there and testify. But you're exactly right. I think in reality, the terms are used almost interchangeably. And in State v. Cook, I think they're generally referring to it as competency. But what we're talking about here in this case is it's a case out of Caldwell County that we got on February 18th of 2026. We don't get a whole lot of facts. We just know that the defendant here, it had something to do with him apparently stealing some catalytic converters, and he was found guilty at trial of felony larceny, felony possession of stolen goods, and a felony conspiracy to commit felony larceny. What we do know is more about sort of the setup of this, dealing with this competency or capacity issue for the defendant. On March 13th of 2023, the defense counsel asked for a forensic evaluation based on some concerns that they had about the defendant not taking his medication, his apparently confused thought processing, and not really understanding his situation. There were a couple of additional orders that got entered in April and May because the defendant couldn't initially be located to have that evaluation done, but it was finally done back in May of 2023. And the person there, I believe it's Michelle Strobel for a place called Breathe Wellness Counseling, performed that evaluation and rendered an opinion that the defendant was not competent or lacked capacity to proceed, talking about those things like the disorganized thinking process, impaired communication, and so forth. Relying on that, the judge in the case entered an order in June of 2023. The defendant was not currently competent to proceed and directing that an updated evaluation be completed in September. A second evaluation for the defendant was done at Central Regional by Dr. Amy Leeper, and so that report got issued in March of 2024. Dr. Leeper concluded the defendant was competent to proceed. She acknowledged some concerns about these prior psychotic symptoms and cautioned that substance abuse, for example, could negatively influence his ability to continue assisting in his own defense. But the issue is that the trial court evidently received this second report, but never really formally adopted it or entered an order saying, okay, I'm adopting these new findings and I am finding the defendant now has capacity to proceed. The closest we get is there's an administrative hearing that happens July 1st of 2024. And the prosecutor there, because you know now we've all gotten the second report, right? So the prosecutor asks the judge whether, quote, the last eval found the defendant was capable to proceed, quote, and then asks whether the court, and this is the other part of the quote, needed to go through anything in Chapter 15A. And the defense counsel responded, I don't think so. And the court made no further inquiries after that or an actual finding on competency. So after that hearing in July, the case is actually tried in December, and the defendant is convicted. So this is the error that the defendant is alleging on appeal, saying, look at the record, right? The only order that was actually in effect was this prior one saying the defendant lacks capacity to proceed. And then some records or materials or opinions were offered saying, perhaps he does have capacity to proceed, but we never really have a clear finding from the judge about that. So he's saying it was error to proceed to trial without actually holding some new competency hearing or entering those findings, restoring his competency based on that subsequent order. In other words, the June 2023 order was never vacated or superseded or anything. So that is still, in the defendant's argument, that's the binding order. That's where things stood on the day that the defendant was put to trial, you know, with a binding order in the record saying this person lacks capacity to proceed. The state on appeal sort of makes an argument about, can't this be waived, right? I mean, yes, we do have the statute 15A 1001 and 15A 1002 setting out the procedures, and it says that the defendant shall not be put to trial. But the Court of Appeals makes a point of saying these statutes really just embody and give effect to constitutional protections that a person who lacks capacity to proceed will not be put to criminal trial and, you know, potentially locked up in prison. So looking at that 15A10.02, they explain that what it requires the court to do is conduct this hearing whenever the capacity to proceed is in question and enter findings supporting its determination. As to this prior order versus the new unadopted report, they say this: although the statute does not explicitly state that an incompetency adjudication remains effective until vacated, our appellate decisions compel that conclusion. And they walk through some case law like McRae, basically saying if that's what's been found and it has not changed, then that is still where we are. The argument, I think, Joe, something you and I talked about was, what about this administrative hearing, right? I mean, you know, the defense attorney, because it seemed like the prosecutor was trying to bring this up about, hey, we've gotten this new report. Is there anything we need to do here under 15A? And, you know, do we need to make some findings? You know, the answer here from the Court of Appeals is yes, the judge should have made that finding and had the hearing. But what about the fact that defense counsel said, I don't think so, and then there's no further inquiry from the court? Isn't that some kind of a waiver or something? You know, but the Court of Appeals says no. You know, that there's a difference between the statutory right to a competency hearing, which could be waived, but then there's also this constitutional right, this due process right, to not be tried while you lack the capacity to assist in your own defense or understand the proceedings against you,
Jonathan,
and that can't be waived.
It just seems like the fact is not that this defendant lacked capacity, right? Because we did have this forensic evaluation that came up with a determination that he had regained capacity. So I'm not sure how that constitutional right is triggered here so much as just a legalistic requirement that it has to be formalized in a judicial finding.
So, Joe, that I think is what really gets us to the interesting and I would say even frustrating part of this case is, all right, if that's where we are, right? If you're saying, look, we get it, right? There was another report that he did have capacity to proceed, but hey, look at the paperwork, right? The only thing that was signed was the prior order saying you lack capacity, and there was no formal adoption of the new report, even though it seems like maybe everybody was on board with the new report. I agree with you. And I think that sets up the question of, okay, then what is the remedy in this case? If this is an order because at least on paper, we hadn't marked him as having capacity restored, then what could we do, what we've done in a number of other cases?
Just send it back for entry of this new order, right?
Exactly. Or not even just to enter the order, but in a lot of these other cases where, for example, they've said that the trial court failed to sua sponte, evaluate the capacity. What they would do in other cases is say, let's send it back to the trial court to let the trial court determine, can we do a retrospective determination of their capacity to proceed? Let the judge look at it and say, even though time has passed, I can look at the records, I remember the hearings, I remember seeing him, I remember talking to him, I've read the transcripts. Can I determine today that he did, in fact, have capacity back at that time? Reading this opinion, that's where I thought we were going to go. But that is not where we get to. In this case, the Court of Appeals, after talking about these issues that we've addressed and saying, you know, look, we are where we are. He was deemed incompetent and that wasn't changed. We next consider the appropriate remedy. And they point out a new trial is not automatically required if a meaningful retrospective determination of competency remains possible. Again, citing to that McRae case. But they say this case does not permit such a retrospective determination. That last order was from June, and then they say, here's the quote, although a subsequent forensic evaluation dated 11 March 2024 opined that the defendant was competent, the trial court never adopted that evaluation or entered findings restoring competency, and defendant's trial did not commence until 10 December 2024, approximately 9 months later. And then here's the end. Under these circumstances, any retrospective determination would necessarily rely on stale evidence or contradict the trial court's last findings. And then a little bit more before they say, accordingly, defendant's convictions must be vacated. And so they vacate the convictions. That did surprise me a little bit because of the points you raised, Joe. I mean, you know, that, yes, I understand some time has passed, but right there in that moment, they had the new report and there was this hearing even that was held where everybody was in court together and evidently assessed it and thought there was no longer an issue with capacity and was prepared to proceed. I looked back just for, you know, anything recent dealing with one of those retrospective capacity determinations. The first one I came across was State versus Hollers, a case we got in October of last year, not that long ago, which was a case where concerns were raised on the first day of trial, which was January 8th of 2018. And then after he's convicted, it's argued on appeal that the court should have looked into capacity. Court of Appeals agreed with that. So they remanded it back for the trial court to determine, you know, can't, that's really how it works. I mean, you know, they're not directing them to do it. They're asking the trial court, you tell us, because you know better than we do, do you think you can do a retrospective capacity hearing? And if you can, then do one and let us know where we stand, which is what they did in that Hollers case. And that trial court conducted those retrospective hearings on the 12th and 13th of July, 2023. 5.5 years later, the trial court assessed it and said, yes, I think we can do this hearing. I've done it. I'm satisfied the judge had capacity. And that on review, the Court of Appeals said the trial court did not err in concluding that the defendant was competent to stand trial and did not err in entering its order. So I'm not surprised at the finding. You know, I mean, if he was deemed to lack capacity and then nothing officially was changed, I'm not surprised we find error. Very surprised at the remedy. I would have expected them to just order a retrospective hearing, but that's not what they did.
Well, so the convictions are vacated. And I guess the remaining question is, can the state go back now and have a new finding of capacity judicially entered and try the defendant again?
I think that's what they're going to need to do. I mean, the Court of Appeals says this case is vacated and remanded for new trial. That's maybe one way to look at it, is we're going to have to assess this capacity issue now regardless. But assuming that the trial court does find he has capacity to proceed today, rather than just hanging on to these already obtained verdicts, it looks like if the state wants to convict him, they would have to try that same case over again.
Second case we had on for today is State v. Villarreal. This is a case out of McDowell County. Back in January of 2022, Ethan Troutman, who ends up being the victim in this case, and Dante Davidson got into an argument over the phone about money that Davidson allegedly owed Troutman. Davidson, at the time, was at defendant's home. Defendant told Troutman to come to his residence to get the money. Troutman and a guy named Bobby Thomas drove to defendant's home in Thomas's car. Troutman arrived at defendant's home around 7:45 p.m. He stepped out onto the sidewalk. Davidson came outside of the home to meet Troutman. He said he didn't have the money that he owed Troutman. Troutman at that point told Davidson to give him the chain that he was wearing, and he reached for it, and Davidson pushed Thomas's hand away. At that point, Troutman pulled out a metal retractable baton. Davidson apparently backed into the front yard, yelling out he has a weapon. At this point, defendant stepped out onto his front porch with a gun. Troutman turned and started to run away, and defendant shot Troutman in the back. Troutman was able to get back to Thomas's car, got into the car. Thomas began to drive away without realizing that Troutman had been shot. When Thomas realized that Troutman had been injured, he stopped the car. They called 911, but Troutman ultimately died from his injuries. In January of 2022, defendant was indicted for murder. At trial, over defendant's objection, the state gave a jury instruction on the aggressor doctrine. The aggressor doctrine is the proposition that an aggressor is one who initially provoked the use of force against himself or continued to pursue a fight that the other person was trying to leave. And the aggressor instruction in a murder trial typically says an aggressor is not entitled to perfect self-defense. Defendant was convicted of second-degree murder, sentenced to 254 to 317 months and appealed. Before the Court of Appeal, defendant argued that the trial court erred by instructing the jury on that aggressor doctrine. Under General Statute 14-51.3, a person is justified in the use of deadly force and does not have a duty to retreat in any place he has a lawful right to be under two circumstances. One, he reasonably believes such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or to another. Or two, under the circumstances permitted pursuant to General Statute 14-51.2. 51.2 is the so-called Castle Doctrine that says the lawful occupant of a home, motor vehicle, or workplace when using deadly force is presumed to have had a reasonable fear of imminent death or serious bodily harm if an intruder was unlawfully and forcibly entering and the lawful occupant knew or had reason to know about the unlawful and forcible entry. Crucial here is the following statute, 14-51.4. That statute says the justification described in 14-51.2, the Castle Doctrine, and 14-51.3, the general self-defense rules, is not available to a person who used defensive force and who, among other things, initially provoked the use of force against himself. The Court of Appeals explained that that statute, 14-51.4, is a codification of the common law aggressor doctrine. Under a prior North Carolina Supreme Court precedent called State v. Hicks, Someone who did not instigate a fight may still be an aggressor if he continues to pursue a fight that the other person is trying to leave. And the other case that the Court of Appeals cited here is a case called State v. Cannon for the proposition that being shot in the back supports an inference that the victim was trying to leave the altercation. Here, the Court of Appeals said there was evidence from which the jury could infer that defendant was acting as the aggressor, quote, when he invited Troutman to his residence and shot him in the back. The Court of Appeals cited the fact that several witnesses testified defendant told Troutman to come to his home and gave him the address. Several witnesses all testified Troutman never raised or swung his baton at Davidson, and then it was uncontested that defendant shot Troutman in the back as he was trying to run away. So the Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court did not err by instructing the jury on the aggressor doctrine and found ultimately no error.
So, Joe, I mean, I can understand saying that somebody is probably, or at least arguably, the aggressor in a situation where they're shooting somebody else in the back, right? I mean, that person, what do you make of this language about him being the aggressor? Because it's an and, right? They say, what do you make of that part where they say he's the aggressor when he invited Troutman to his residence? That makes him an aggressor?
Yeah, that's a little odd. I think it has to be maybe confined to these circumstances where, as you pointed out earlier, there was some conflicting evidence as to what was going on in the altercation. And the Court of Appeals says early on, they're reciting the facts that are most favorable to the state. That was the party who requested the aggressor instruction here. But just as a freestanding proposition, I'm not aware of any other precedent that would suggest that just by inviting someone to the home makes a person an aggressor. You can imagine a situation where somebody provided kind of a pretextual invitation, thinking in his heart of hearts, I'm going to get that person here and start an argument, and then I can claim that he started a fight so that I can use deadly force. I think that would be a different scenario because there's no indication here that the invitation was extended with any other purpose than to exchange this money that was allegedly owed. There was no indication, in other words, that the defendant lured the victim to the house with this false friendly invitation in order to use deadly force. So I find that language the Court of Appeals used when he invited Troutman to the residence and shot him in the back to be a little troubling. I don't think there's really any basis to say just a mere invitation makes somebody an aggressor.
When I was reading this, I was thinking, I mean, maybe we kind of need to read that invited with sort of an asterisk next to it. I mean, because again, we don't have the transcript. We just have this summary of the facts in the light most favorable to the state. But just reading through that, you know, they're talking about how they're arguing about something about a Netflix password, and then he wouldn't give it to him because some argument about owing money. And it says, aggression escalated between Troutman and Davidson over a series of subsequent phone calls, which were placed on speakerphone. Defendant eventually told Troutman to come to his residence to get the money and gave him the address. And then he's picking up somebody else on the way. I mean, we're calling it invited, but I mean, this almost sounds more like a, you want that money, you come over here and take it, or
maybe
something like that. There's more involved. That's not entirely clear to me.
But I would just caution prosecutors moving forward. I don't think this case stands for the proposition that a mere invitation is going to turn somebody into an aggressor. I mean, you also have to have the fact that the victim was shot in the back while he was trying to run away.
Right.
And then the last case we had on for today was State v. Sanchez.
Yes. So this is a very interesting set of facts in a case that we got out of Avery County that was decided by the Court of Appeals on February 18th. It involves an incident that happens between a 17-year-old high school student and then school resource officer who's the kind of the supervisor or running this police explorers program that she's participating in. So this happened back in June of 2021. The victim, Anne, is part of this police explorers program, and she was invited to go on an afternoon ride along with the defendant, starting around 4 or 5 p.m. They meet up with another deputy for dinner as part of being out, along with some other officers and an intern. It's disputed testimony as to exactly what happens at that dinner and what happens afterward. But what the victim, Anne, would say happened is that at the dinner that they were sort of threatening her, teasing her with this taser, saying that they were going to they unhooked their tasers, acted like they were going to use them on her. And then after dinner, they eventually went back to the Avery County Sheriff's Office parking lot before heading over to this other building at a community college where they wash their cars and trucks. And there, the defendant is telling Ann that she is going to be tased that night and there is nothing that she can do about it. That he actually opened the door to her car, drew his taser, put it near her leg, didn't actually tase her at that point, but shortly after that did then go over and tase this other person who they call Kyle, who was with him, tased him in the arm. They then went inside the building There, she said that this other officer, Marshall, and the defendant ordered her to tase herself with the taser that they were providing, said that if she didn't stop sweating, that they were going to kill her, that they would tase her if she didn't do it herself. And so, you know, finally compelled and forced, she had to do it on herself. The defendant would offer a very different version of events. The defendant would say, first at the dinner, that's not what happened. There was some conversation about it, but we certainly didn't pull our tasers out. We were just sort of teasing her or talking about it with a cell phone or some other object off of the table. And would also dispute the idea that they ever threatened her with it or actually tased her themselves. They would say that, in fact, she had always, or for a long period of time, been talking about how she wanted to be tased. She wanted to have this experience of being tased. And so she asked them if they could do it. And so they let her have their taser. While holding it, she kept turning it off and on, saying, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it, but would change your mind. They asked for it back. She wouldn't give it back. And then finally tased herself. And then the officers would say, rather than being frightened and terrified and upset, that in fact she was just sort of laughing and enjoying life and thought that it was funny. The defendant here was charged, based on all that, once it came to light, with two things. He was charged under 14-316.1, a Class 1 misdemeanor, for knowingly or willfully cause, encourage, or aid any juvenile within the jurisdiction of the court to be in a place or condition or commit an act whereby the juvenile could be adjudicated abused as defined by General Statute 7B101 and 1501. In other words, allowing or contributing to the abuse or neglect of a juvenile, and then also charged with willful failure to discharge his duties under 14-230. There was a trial on this. There was an agent from the SBI, Holder, who testified about sheriff's deputies' duties, including the duty to enforce criminal laws in North Carolina. Also talked about how school resource officers have a specific responsibility to protect children in their schools. The jury, based on all of that, in September of 2023, found the defendant guilty of both charges, contributing to the abuse of a juvenile under 14-316.1 and failure to discharge duties of office under 14-230. On appeal, the defendant is arguing that the trial court erred in denying his motions to dismiss on both of those charges. And ultimately, the Court of Appeals here agrees and says that those motions to dismiss should have been granted. I was going to say based on the facts, but really I would say based on essentially the elements of the charge. So as to that first one, right, contributing to the abuse of a juvenile, I sort of read out the basics of the statute, but what it talks about is saying that under 7B101, an abused juvenile can be determined or found in several ways, but the trial court instructed the jury on only one of them under 101.1b, which says an abused juvenile is one whose parent, guardian, custodian, or caretaker creates or allows to be created a substantial risk of serious physical injury to the juvenile by other than accidental means. And so the way they're explaining this is they're saying under this statute, 14-316.1, there's essentially two key things that the state has to prove. First, they would have to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant did knowingly or willfully cause, encourage, or aid the juvenile to be in a place or condition whereby the juvenile could be adjudicated abused. And I would argue we probably have that here. I mean, whether you are actually chasing her and threatening her with a taser, or I would say unwisely handing a teenage child your duty taser and encouraging them or offering or allowing them to tase themselves with it. Either way, I think a jury could be satisfied that you've put that juvenile in a place or condition where they could be adjudicated abused. But there's the second part of it, right? That the state has to show by clear and convincing evidence that the juvenile qualifies as abused under this 7B101.1b. And that's the issue here, is the state didn't have any evidence they could offer to show that the what they call the required connection to a parent, guardian, custodian, or caretaker. I mean, if we think about it, okay, yes, this defendant is the school resource officer. He's obviously in some kind of a position of, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, supervision or authority or something through this police explorers program that Anne is participating in, but he's not a parent, right? He's not her legal guardian. So
why not caretaker? Sounds to me like he's a caretaker.
I think that is probably how the state was looking at it. And the Court of Appeals even says the defendant may appear to have been acting as a, quote, caretaker for Anne in the colloquial sense, but was not a caretaker as defined by the relevant statute. You know, and that's really what this comes down to, Joe, is we're just sort of bound by the words of the statute.
And what is the relevant statute of the definition of caretaker?
So I think what they're focusing on is that when they're talking about a caretaker, they say it is any person other than a parent, guardian, or custodian who has responsibility for the health and welfare of a juvenile in a residential setting. And so then they go through and they talk about how caretaker could be step-parents, foster parents, you know, other adult members of the household who serve in that role, the uncle or whoever that is, you know, sort of in that role in the house. All of those people could be somebody who maybe qualifies as a caretaker for this juvenile. But this officer who's just sort of, I don't know, entrusted with the safety on these ride-alongs, that's not really rising to that level of being a caretaker or certainly not a parent or guardian under that. So they say...
Well, it sounds to me like the tasing didn't happen in the appropriate place. If it had happened in the juvenile's home, maybe that would have been different?
I think still then we would have to look at what role does this person have in that home? If he were the boyfriend of the mother and he lived there or something, you know, I mean, he could be in that kind of parental role. But they say here the defendant just doesn't fit this definition. He did not reside with Anne. He did not have parental type responsibility for her daily care and did not supervise her in a residential setting. You know, so this is a ride along. It's part of this Police Explorers program. And they say a ride along is not a residential setting. We may have this contributing or creating this risk, but this link then we need to say to link it to being a parent or guardian or custodian or caretaker, we just don't really have either from him or allowing some other person to do it. We don't have that there.
Okay, so we kick the conviction for contributing to the abuse of a juvenile. But what about failing to discharge duties of, I mean, he handed over his taser, right?
He did. And so, but, you know, the state's argument here is saying, all right, that is a failure to discharge your duties, right? Because your duty as an officer is enforce the law, which I guess you would say by extension means don't violate the law. Don't commit crimes. And the state's position is, it says, contends that the defendant violated 14-230 by failing to enforce 14-316.1, the law prohibiting contributing to the abuse of a juvenile, because his conduct contributed to the abuse of the victim. So that means he failed to carry out his duty to enforce the law. But the Court of Appeals here again says no on that, that the motion to dismiss should have been granted. So 14-230, failure to discharge duties, three elements to that. You got to be an officer of a state institution. Second, you willfully omit, neglect, or refuse to discharge a duty. And third, an injury to the public has to occur because of that omission, neglect, or refusal. And here they're saying the state has failed to present any substantial evidence of that second element. Because again, remember the theory that's being argued is the defendant failed to enforce 14-316.1 by violating it. Well, but we just decided he didn't actually violate 14-316.1 because he's not this parent or guardian or caretaker. But then even if he had, I don't think they would go there because they say that this statute, 14-230, doesn't criminalize violating laws. It criminalizes omitting, neglecting, or refusing to perform required duties. And the state cannot point to any specific duty that the defendant failed to perform. In their words, encouraging a juvenile to tase herself is acting. The defendant did something, not nothing. So, in other words, if this thing that he did were its own standalone crime, we would prosecute him for that, not for failure to discharge your duty as an officer. So that one's gone. But then when we look at the act that is being charged, we find that not to be a crime either.
And well, the Court of Appeals goes further. Doesn't it say even a police officer's committing a violation of the law could not be charged with failing to discharge duties under this theory that doing something is categorically different from not doing something?
They do, Joe. That's sort of the towards the end of that holding. They say on that reasoning, any officer who violates a criminal statute could also be charged with willfully failing to discharge his duties simply because he committed a crime, right? That idea of one of your duties as an officer is enforce the laws, don't break the laws. And so you are failing to carry out that duty when you do that. But the Court of Appeals disagrees and says nothing in Section 14-230 supports that reading. So they are not willing to make it go that far. And, you know, they do talk about some of the other case law. We don't have a ton. Actually, in fact, your colleague, my former colleague, Jeff Welty's got a blog post that people might want to look at about failure to discharge duties, and he looks at some of the limited case law we've had on that. Generally, where they're finding that is where it's something more egregious, you know, officers who are, the failure to discharge your duty is you were, I don't know, on the take from the drug dealer and you're tipping him off that the search is about to happen, or, you know, they're accepting bribes or something a little more culpable. But I think here the Court of Appeals is saying, we're not willing to say going forward that any officer who commits a crime, this could be an additional charge that we tack on. They just don't think that's what this was really intended for. So,
Jonathan, could you tell from that, is the Court of Appeals rejecting a theory that was alleged at trial? In other words, was the prosecutor at trial making the argument that the failure to discharge duties consisted of the violation contributing to the abuse of a juvenile? Or was that just an argument that the state made on appeal that might have been substituted for a different argument in support of this second charge?
So the trial court here instructed the jury the state had to prove that the defendant omitted, neglected, or refused to discharge a duty of his office enforcing the criminal laws of this state by encouraging a juvenile to use an Avery County taser on herself.
Oh, so it sounds like the theory that the state was actually pursuing at trial. And so this was not a scenario where the state maybe on appeal could say, all right, well, if that failure to discharge duties won't work, we'll just substitute in something else.
Right. I think that was sort of the very particular version of this that the state was pursuing, you know, was what was this alleged sort of tandem connection between the two, you know, that the failure to discharge duties was as an officer who should be enforcing the laws, such as the law against allowing a juvenile to be adjudicated abused, or that, you know, instead you're encouraging this juvenile to use a police taser on herself.
I was just thinking it might be possible to argue that the failure to maintain possession or control of your own service weapons might be a failure to discharge a duty. But I guess if that was not a theory floated at trial, maybe the state was not in a position to raise that on appeal.
And I certainly don't know all the facts of this case. I mean, I would have to imagine that there was some kind of administrative action taken, you know, by the law enforcement agency to address this in one way or another. I don't know what the outcome of that may have been, but at least as to the criminal charges here, the Court of Appeals, you know, they acknowledge. I mean, they say we get it that this is kind of disturbing conduct, but just, you know, as a strict matter of reading the elements and reading the statutes, we just can't see how to get there on either one of these. So those convictions are vacated.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Cook, vacating the judgment where the trial court proceeded without first determining that the defendant's competency had been restored, State v. Villarreal, finding no error in the trial court's instructing the jury on the aggressor doctrine when the evidence showed the defendant shot the victim in the back, and State v. Sanchez, reversing the defendant's convictions for contributing to the abuse of a juvenile and failing to discharge the duties of his office. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's a topic you want us to cover later, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.